Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we are collectively Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens around New York City and the surrounding area, and our show brings the culture to culture. So, as you know, if you've been following along, we have this new format, one whole hour, and we are devoting our shows to all things budding, as we usually do. But this year, we are following the USDA map.
Yep.
Our theme this year is land and climate. Our country is so big, and we have so much diversity in land, people, weather, and climate. We wanted to highlight that by using this USDA map as a guide. So our shows will now focus on one zone per month and the people and the places that make it unique. We will talk to gardeners, farmers, extension agents, botanists, writers, and growers, and designers who reflect new, unique, and relevant ideas for each zone. We're going to share their stories with you each month and periodically on our blog, and maybe create a little zone envy in the process. So we are in New York City and in Brooklyn, and we garden in Zone 7B. So that means on average, the coldest it gets in our zone is 5 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Not warm enough for Carmen's lemon trees to remain outside, but great for all sorts of other plants. The map is what growers, gardeners, and anyone working in horticulture uses to determine what can grow where. It's a guide to your patch of earth. So when you buy a plant, it often lists its hardiness zone, which will help you decide if you can grow it where you live, or if you have to bring it inside for the winter.
Now imagine if you didn't have this, right? You'd go to the nursery, you'd have to bring like an encyclopedia with you, or trust the person that's selling you the plants, which, you know, sometimes is okay, but not always. So today we're going to talk about Zone 8. And to do that, we travel to Texas. And in fact, we explore two distinct sides of one of our biggest states. Now, Texas is so big that the USDA had to make two separate maps, one for the east side and one for the west side of the state. The only other state that has it divided that way is California.
Mm-hmm. North and south.
North
right.
and south, exactly. But Texas is kind of split down the middle, east to west. So before we bring our guests on...
Kind of like the Hatfields and the McCoys.
Yeah, yeah, I'm wearing a McCoy outfit right now.
Carmen is. She's got some blue piping and a brown shirt on that's got some floral motif.
It's Wrangler.
She's looking a little Western.
I decided to get in the mood.
She's a little Western today.
A little Western today. But I'm not wearing the Canadian tuxedo. I will not do that.
Little
Dave,
cowboy music.
I want you to play Horse with No Name. I just listened to that. I think it made good background. Anyway, so As I discovered in my research, Zone 8 is really interesting, and it covers a huge swath of the United States. Most of the Florida Panhandle is Zone 8. Zone 8 also cuts through the whole of the southern U.S. from just south of Raleigh, North Carolina, through central and southern Georgia, across to Montgomery, Alabama, Jackson, Mississippi, and up to Little Rock, Arkansas.
It's a big one.
It's big. In the mid-Atlantic states, it touches the coasts of Maryland and Virginia, but doesn't cross the Mason-Dixon line, which is probably wise. Zone 8 sweeps west to Dallas and Austin, Texas, where we're going to talk about today, and in fact covers most of central Texas down to the Rio Grande and the border of New Mexico. Now, past the Rockies, there are parts of western Washington State and Oregon that also lie in this temperate zone. So if you live and garden in Zone 8, your winter temperatures don't go much below 10 to 20 degrees Fahrenheit, as that is the average extreme minimum it gets in winter, which is pretty great. So you can grow a lot of great plants in that zone that just wouldn't make it a zone colder where we are. For example, Podocarpus, some varieties of Camellia, Elysium, certain crepe myrtles, and some varieties of boxwood that need protection in our zone and colder can grow without it in Zone 8. Loropetalum.
My favorite.
Yeah, I mean, it struggles to grow in our zone, but it's beautiful in the southern garden.
Mm-hmm.
Oleander, Pittosporum, those are the plants that when I see them in the south give me zone envy. So, anyway.
I'm sorry, that phrase always cracks me up.
I know, it sounds so trite, but
it's funny.
It's funny. So we, you know, because of such a wide swath of U.S. covered by Zone 8, the options were numerous, but I decided to choose Texas because of its kind of split personality and because so much of the state is covered by Zone 8. So I chose two areas. I chose Austin because it's the state capital. It kind of represented for me the urban, modern Texas, hip, 21st century Texas, and it's right at the heart of the eastern part of Texas on the USDA map. For western Texas, I chose the little town of Alpine, which lies in the Big Bend area of the state. This is the hilly, mountainous part of Texas that much fewer people visit than Austin or Dallas, but which contains some of the most unique landscapes in the continental United States. This area, as one resident of the area told me, is on the way to nowhere. And I suspect some of the people there like it that way. So this big state of opposites and contradictions in climate and topography.
That's it.
So it really fascinated me. Yes, Dave, yes. But I still want Horse with No Name because it's about the desert. Anyway, so I visited Texas many, many years ago. I visited Dallas and the whole, like, concrete sprawl of Dallas. I visited the humid resort town of Galveston, which, like, kind of has more in common with Louisiana than Texas.
Mm-hmm.
But the place that I found the most magical was the Hill Country, just outside of San Antonio, and specifically the town of New Braunfels, Texas, which is between Austin and San Antonio, that really blew my mind. It's like a little piece of Germany transplanted to Texas, right? And I never expected to see anything like that there. And this, we're talking like 25 years ago now. This is well before I went to visit the Midwest and married a Kansan. I'd never seen that kind of open landscape. Like where I come from in Italy, there's lots of open space, but there's mountains.
It's rock, and
you feel enclosed. But here, this was the first place that I was like, oh my God, America is huge. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just so huge. And it really fundamentally changed how I thought about space.
I remember,
you know,
flying in an airplane over Texas, and it went on and on,
yeah,
and on. And I kept looking out the window. What's happening now? Oh, same thing. There we go. Same thing. Yep.
Yeah.
Bigness. Big, empty space.
So big. So we have found the perfect guest to talk about her part of Texas. Her name is Jenny Nybro-Peterson, and she is from Brooklyn.
Ah.
Okay. But
one in every eight people you meet is from Brooklyn.
But she now lives in Texas. Jenny is a garden designer and urban homesteader in Austin, Texas, as well as the author of The Cancer Survivor's Garden Companion, Cultivating Hope, Healing, and Joy in the Ground Beneath Your Feet, published by St. Lin's Press. Jenny, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carmen and Alice. It sounds like you guys are having an early happy hour over there.
No, it's only 1:15 in the afternoon here, but you know.
We're only having smoothies.
We're just giggly. We're just giggly.
I don't have coffee, which is unusual for me. But.
So, Jenny, I saw online that you had your foot in a boot. Are you okay?
Yes, I'm okay. It's not a broken foot. I tore a ligament. And actually, more specifically, I was stupid, you guys. I know y'all are going to ask me about my urban farm in a little bit, but I was dumb, and I, against my better judgment, I got into a rush to go out and feed the goats, and I wore flip-flops. How stupid is that? I know better. And so one of my goats stepped on my foot.
Oh, ouch.
Oh, God.
Yeah. It's my fault, though. You know, that's 1 to 2 months or longer recovery. I've already been at it for a month now, and it's going to be 1 to 2 months more during high garden season.
Did they break any bones?
What's that?
Did you get any broken bones in your foot?
No, broken bone. I got a bruised bone, and I got a torn ligament.
Ouch. Oh, God. I feel
for
you.
Good for bending over.
I can only imagine. Ooh. So I mentioned that your family's from Brooklyn.
My mom and dad were born in Brooklyn and raised in Staten Island.
Tell us how you ended up in Austin, Texas, in Zone 8.
Okay, so my dad was in the Army, so we moved around quite a bit. I was actually born in Washington State, although I have no memories of that. We moved away from there to Germany when I was very young. And then we settled in San Antonio, where my father retired. So I mostly, like from fifth grade on, I was in San Antonio.
Mm-hmm. One of our gardeners.
I'm not a native Texan, but I've spent a good majority of my life here.
Right. So you feel like a native Texan, kind of.
I do. Yeah. I do. I say y'all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that count?
Well, what is it in New York? If you've lived here for 10 years, you can consider yourself a New Yorker, right?
Is that the rule?
Oh,
I think it's 10 years because you develop the cynicism and the aggravated
attitude.
So I would say, you know, you've got the y'all. You're a Texan by that standard.
So, I agree.
So tell us tell us about your path to becoming a garden designer and builders. What led you to horticulture? Because it wasn't a direct path, like for so many of us, it's not.
No, it wasn't at all. I actually do come from a family of gardeners. I like to joke when I do speaking engagements that I'm from a large family. There's 6 kids in my family, and all of us are gardeners except for one. My brother Philip says that he went to college so that he doesn't have to do this. And nobody, we just think he's like this alien, but we set a, you know, place for him at the Christmas table. Nonetheless.
Sympathy plates.
I came from a family of gardeners, and I actually trained, believe it or not, this is so out there, to be a therapist within the church framework. Is that not out there? That's so different.
Wow. Well, you kind of need to be a little bit of a therapist to be a garden designer. We know that.
Well, okay. So here's the deal. I think it's all interrelated. I got teased earlier in my life for just running around and collecting degrees and certifications. But, you know, sometimes you just kind of have to go with it and know that your passion is going to lead you somewhere where these things intersect. And it did. So after I graduated from graduate school, I have a master's degree in theology. I stayed at home with my kids for, gosh, like 10 years. And during that time, I got certified as a master gardener.
Mm-hmm.
So then people, you know, just friends and family started asking me to come help them design things in their yards. And you and I know that, you know, being a master gardener, that's not the main designer I have for designing. So I just started doing some of these little jobs on the side about 15 years ago. It was probably 2001 or 2002. I opened my design business, and then it just went from there. So I never really intended. It was not my life goal to be a landscape designer, but I love it.
And your partner is your husband, right?
Yes. Well, you know, we have 2 separate companies, and this is actually how we met 11 years ago, was on a job site. So I design all these crazy things, and he's the installer. He's the brains behind it and tries to figure out how to put in my crazy designs.
Yeah, that's a good combo.
That is perfect, Jenny.
Yeah.
It is, because, like, you know, back in the early days when we first started working together, you guys, I would say, okay, look at this design. Isn't this awesome? This is, like, the best design ever. And he would take a glance at it, and he'd say, it's great if you don't mind drainage problems that you just created.
Yeah.
You know, so I'd say, well, that's why you're here. You're here to fix that.
So tell me a wacky design that you guys have come up with and installed.
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand you.
Tell me one of the wackier designs that you all have implemented.
One of the rockier ones. Hmm.
No, wacky, crazy.
Yeah, crazy, wacky.
Yeah.
Got it. Well, Rocky could
be too.
Describe
yeah.
it.
Right.
Let's see. One of the crazier ones was I remember one. We have nicknames for every dog.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, I don't even know how that happened, but we had one that was the wheelbarrow job because literally the access was so damn bad. Sorry, I just cussed on your show.
That's okay.
The access was so bad that our crew hated us. Everything had to go in wheelbarrows. The front yard was divided into levels. It had split tiers. We had to go up the tiers. We had to go through a very narrow gate, up more tiers, and then carry the wheelbarrows across a water feature and then get to the other part of the yard. They hated us. They absolutely hated us. My crew, not the client.
Right, yeah. We've been on those jobs. We know about those jobs too. And you just smile and keep buying coffee and pizza and like.
Yeah, we did lots of happy hours. We're like, you guys just get through today and I've got cold beer waiting for you at the end of the day.
Yeah.
We let them play their music really loud and whatever it is that gets them through it. But that was a really tough one.
Yeah.
That is tough. So let's talk about speaking of wildness and wackiness, Texas weather, right?
Yeah.
So you garden in Austin, Texas. Every time I think it's crazy here. Then I hear about the weather report in Texas. It's like a land of extremes. So can you tell us a little bit about what the weather patterns are like seasonally there, Jenny, and how that impacts what you design, how you design and maintain the gardens?
Absolutely. It is a land of extremes. We have like warm weather and we have cold weather. We don't have the change of seasons that other states or other zones in the United States have. It's either like really hot or pretty cold. And people don't really understand this about this part of Texas, but we can actually get, you know, hard freezes. We do get ice storms. We can get snow. So even though it's, you know, central Texas, it can still get pretty cold. So, for example, our succulents will freeze. You know, we're not like Southern California where you grow them into tree-like forms.
Mm-hmm.
It can get blistering hot in the summertime. Like August and September I don't even want to go outside. It's like a sauna outside. It's very, very uncomfortable. You have to be really acclimated to working in that kind of weather. And the crew is, I'm not, because I'm not out there every day with them doing, and I don't do what they do. You know, I show up when the plants, come
right
on the job site. But, you know, even in Austin from Carmen, I think I was telling you about this, Interstate 35 intersects Austin from east to west.
Yes.
East of Austin is what we call Blacklands prairie soil, which is, it's a deeper, richer soil. We've got piney woods on that side of the interstate. West of the interstate, where I live, it's rocky, shallower soil, tends to be very alkaline, not very nutrition rich. So you have to really know where you're planting because, like, say, for example, a red oak, you can plant on the east side of 35, but not on the west side.
Oh.
Because it just requires deeper soil for their roots.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have to know your stuff. And then from the north part of Austin to the south part, we're right on the edge of zone 8A to 8B.
That's right.
And that can make a difference too, just like that half zone difference is pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, gardening and landscaping in Austin takes a number of years to really figure out what can grow where from east to west, north to south.
That's so interesting. And why
and it's
you,
pretty crazy.
Yeah. So is 35 on some kind of like fault line or something? Like why is there that demarcation? I'm just curious. Do you know?
You know what? I'm not really sure. That's a good question. I don't think it's on a fault line.
Or something. That's like a pretty strong, like, okay, the soil's completely different.
I think it's just happenstance where Austin was built because, Carmen, earlier when I was on not really on hold, but I could hear you guys talking about, like, the hill country.
Yes.
We're just right on the edge of the hill country, which, as you know, is hilly. It's mm-hmm. rocky. Mm-hmm. Very different terrain over there. And then just east of us is the piney woods of East Texas. And so Austin is situated right in the middle of those two. So we have some of the characteristics of each.
That's interesting. Yeah,
it's kind of fun, but it's can be a little exasperating sometimes.
Yeah. So you do have to know what you're doing. You can't just...
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
You can't just plunk a plant down. You know, you'll... which, you know, in the early days when we're all newbies, that's what I did. I'd go, oh, that red oak, it looks so pretty. I'm going to plant that out in, you know, southwest Austin, and it dies.
Right.
Because the roots just don't have any soil.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like there's some beautiful gardens in Austin and very diverse gardens, too, in terms of style and plant palettes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you just have to, like, with any place, you have to know what your native and adapted plants are and really... You know, that's kind of the Bible for us around here because we just came out of an extended period of about a 7-year drought.
Wow.
And extreme heat.
Wow.
And 2011 was our worst year that anybody could ever remember. A lot of landscapers went out of business.
Wow.
It was really, really disastrous. And we got down to, we're always on water restrictions down here because we live in an area of periodic drought. So... Mm. I tell my clients, you know, if you like to have, you know, impatience and things like that, you're talking to the wrong girl because that it's just, to me, it's not ethical or responsible to plant a garden, not only for myself, but for my clients.
Yeah.
That is not sustainable here in our climate.
Right. But also you want the vernacular is very important, right? You need, the house needs to... The landscape and the house need to be reflective of the setting. Like, there is nothing more ridiculous than the wrong style house in the wrong location
or the
landscape.
And do impatiens look right?
No.
In central Texas? Probably not, you know?
You can use them in, you know, like potted plants.
Yeah.
I have a very small tropical part of my garden that's around my yoga deck, and I've got like 4 impatient plants there.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm willing to water those a little bit.
Right.
And they
right.
do fine, but I'm not willing to have a whole landscape full of thirsty annuals. It's just not.
Exactly.
You know, I live on an acre. I'm not, for me to irrigate this entire acre would literally be about $500 a month, and I'm
right.
not going to do it.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
And it's just not, it's not responsible either.
Right. Right.
Well,
right.
you're mentioning your yoga deck. Reminded me of, we did want to talk about your book, Jenny.
Yeah.
Your latest book is The Cancer Survivor's Companion, published by St. Lin's Press. Can you share with our audience what inspired you to write the book and what you hope readers get out of reading it?
Absolutely. So back in 2012, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And while I was going through treatment, my co-author, Kylie Bomley, and I actually wrote our first garden book while I was in treatment. So now some people call me crazy for doing that, but consider I was going through surgery, chemotherapy, radiation during the hot summer, you know, Texas months. So me being outside a whole lot during that time was not a great idea. So
yeah.
The writing that first book, Indoor Plant Decor, was like the subtitle was The Design Style Book for Houseplants. So that was a perfect thing for me to be doing at that time.
Yeah.
So it was during my recovery, though, you guys, that I started to use and view my own garden in a very different way because, you know, a lot of times when people get done with cancer treatment, they think, and the people around them think, okay, now it's life back to normal. You're done. And it's not life back to normal because your body takes 2 to 3 years, sometimes more, to really fully recover.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during that recovery time that I experienced a lot of side effects from medications. I developed lymphedema in my left arm. I developed nerve damage in my feet from chemotherapy. And that really impacted the way I garden on a practical level. But it also, I felt very depressed. Because my whole lifestyle was changing and my energy level was different. And I started to look at my garden as a resource for healing rather than just a pretty place to go and have fun and garden and, you know, grow some nice plants. So that's when my husband, he was then my fiance, we got engaged about 6 weeks before my diagnosis. So we put off getting married until just this last November. So we're actually, even though we've been together 11 years, we're newlyweds.
Oh, congratulations.
I remember seeing the photos.
So you guys are gonna love this. So I was out in California at a speaking engagement, and I came home. It was 2013. It was my 50th birthday. And while I was gone, my husband and a good friend of ours, Jim, got together and they built me a yoga deck in the backyard. They built it for me for my birthday.
Oh.
And my husband said, he said, I know you haven't been feeling well and you're struggling to, you know, get back to a normal routine or something that feels good to you. And you're staying inside too much because that's what you do when you feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so he built me this yoga deck as a way of helping me to get outside and reconnect.
Yeah.
You know?
I love that. That's a great...
It was during that time that I started thinking, I need to write a book about this, because if I'm having this experience, I know there's a whole lot of other people going through the same thing that are having this experience. And I just wanted everybody to know, if they didn't already know, what a healing resource they have right outside their own back door.
Mm-hmm.
Healing, healing, healing. You know, you get out there, you know, break a light sweat, you're exposed to the sunshine and the beneficial bacteria in the soil. You have the wind on your face. You can smell the scents of the flowers and the plants. You grow nutritious food. It's all so healthy in its body, mind, and spirit.
Right.
It encompasses everything. And there aren't too many things in life that do that. But gardening is one.
Right.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, even if, you know, for anybody, healthy people too,
right?
You know,
exactly, for anybody.
For
that's
anybody,
why I say, you know, it's called the Cancer Survivors Garden Companion, but I cannot even tell you how many messages I've received over the last year from people who have just high stress in their life, or who deal with anxiety or depression or chronic pain or fibromyalgia or anything else, and they've said, "I use your book as a resource for getting myself out into the garden, resetting my mood, reminding myself that life is still good and that I can make it and things are doable." So, you know, the garden does that. It's pretty magical, really.
I want to retitle your book to The New Yorker's Survivor's Garden Companion, Cultivating Hope, Healing, and Joy in the Ground Beneath Your Feet. Because
yes!
There are a lot of New Yorkers that need this, like, theory in their lives, you know?
Yeah, just tweak it, Jenny, and you'll sell, like, millions of copies to stressed out New Yorkers. Yeah.
Millions of copies is good.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have to talk about your garden. We don't have a lot of time left, but I want you to talk about your mini urban farm, which is right in Austin. And you talked about the goat a little bit, but you have chickens, you have a pig that lives with you indoors. Tell us briefly a little bit about your garden farm and how you manage it all while running your business too.
Right.
Well, you know, the pig is actually outdoors now. She was indoors when she was a baby because she was so little. But so we have 12, let's see, we've got 12 goats, although three or four of them are going to be sold here pretty quickly because they're babies, about ready to be weaned. We've got about 40 chickens. We have 10 ducks, a beehive, the one potbelly pig, and two dogs.
Wow.
So
it sounds amazing.
And I have to say, we didn't plan all this out. This was not a master plan to do this, but we have a full acre in Austin, which is very unusual, and all of our neighbors have full acres.
Right. Wow.
So I think, you know, it's just a way that it's a lifestyle for us of living a more sustainable life, of being a little bit closer to the earth, to the ground, to knowing where your food comes from, to being a, you know, an active participant in that life cycle,
mm-hmm.
in all the different ways that we see it.
Mm-hmm.
And it does take a lot of time to take care of these animals responsibly, but it's grounding for us. And, you know, we've got, you know, the raised bed gardens. We have a lot going on 1 acre.
Yeah.
And for me, it's a connecting force, and I do talk about that in my book, The Cancer Survivor's Garden Companion, because I think anything that connects you to nature and the natural world is grounding.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a part of it for me. It's not only, you know, growing food or doing yoga outside around a beautiful garden, but it's interacting with these animals and seeing them through their whole life cycle and, you know, enjoying the fruits of what they give us And just being connected in that way. It's a deep connection with the earth.
It sounds like you're in the perfect environment.
It sounds like a dream.
I don't want to ask you about zone envy because it doesn't sound like you would have any, Jenny.
I do have zone envy. Okay. Not zone envy, but it's like microclimate envy.
Okay.
So, because, okay, so the Pacific Northwest is actually the exact same zone that we are here.
Right.
A-B.
Yes.
Right.
A-A-B. But... And this is interesting. They get the exact same amount of rainfall that we do every year, but we get what's called rain events, where it's a deluge, and then we have all this runoff.
Right.
And then we won't see rain for 3 months, whereas the Pacific Northwest sees it, you know, daily or weekly. Mm-hmm. And so they can grow things like hostas and heuchera and...
ferns,
right.
Know, all those beautiful, you know, moisture-loving plants that I don't have... a chance in hell of growing down here, you know?
Yeah.
So I look at those plants, you know, like our friend Christina Solwitz uses these beautiful plants in her designs. And I'm like, man, well, at least I can do agaves and they can't do agaves.
Yep. Yep.
That's true.
Yep. Yeah, be thankful what you can do, right?
Yeah,
exactly. There's always something.
Yeah, and that's why, Allison, I wanted to focus on the different zones in the country so people can see that there's beauty and there's opportunity to create great gardens and landscapes anywhere.
And use what you have.
Oh,
use what you have.
Right.
So where can people find you next? Do you have some upcoming speaking engagements? And also shout out your website and everything for people to follow, Jenny.
Yes, my website is jennynibropeterson.com. And I'm also on Facebook. I've got a Facebook page, same name as my book, The Cancer Survivor's Garden Companion. And I'm on Facebook also as Jenny Nibro Peterson. And I do have a speaking engagement for people in the Central Texas area coming up this Saturday, the San Antonio Festival of Flowers. I will be speaking there. So typically I speak a lot in the spring and in the fall and the summer months where, you know, it's high landscaping time. So I take a break from speaking during the summer. But also if they check on my website, jennynibropeterson.com, I do have an events page where people can keep up with where I'm going to be at any given time.
Thank you, Jenny. Thank you so much for being on our show. And if I come back to Texas, I'm going to come see you.
You do. You know what? We've got our renovated
RV
trailer in the backyard. You can stay there.
Oh, okay. Awesome.
I'm going to take you up on that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carmen and Alice.
Thanks for joining us.
You guys.
Okay. We're going to take a break, and then when we come back, we're going to visit the desert. Stay tuned.
I went down.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Running from the law out on the land, sent my mama wire telegram.
Hey, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We are talking now about the western part of Texas. We're joined now by Rick Herman, the director of the Chihuahuan Desert Research Institute. Rick, are you on the line?
I am.
Great.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Rick.
Thanks for joining us. So we just got off the phone with Jenny Nibro Peterson, who's in Austin, Texas. And we wanted to kind of split Texas in half like the USDA did, eastern and western parts. So when I was looking for a place to focus on western Texas, I found a town called Alpine. Now, you don't think of Texas as having mountains, right?
Right.
You just don't think that it might have any. And I said, wait a minute, if this place is called Alpine, there's got to be mountains. And I started digging around, and then I found your center. And it was fascinating. The website has these amazing videos of the desert that are so sort of like, I would say, I think they were done in the 80s or early 90s, and they're so like sweet and beautiful, and I think Burl Ives narrates one of them, and it's like, it's just so amazing. So I really wanted to have you on to talk about this place, you know? So we've got some some.
And here's a horse with no name, Carm.
Right? I asked Dave for that. So we're in the desert, but you're so from good. Texas, but you lived in New York for a little while, isn't that right, Rick? Rick, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So you lived
horse
in...
with no name was playing, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, those films that you allude to, which are on our website, which is cdri.org, as you pointed out, are, you know, 40 years old. And they and the desert, we think, are both similarly timeless.
Yeah.
So, yeah. The connection that you make through those videos is the connection that so many people make when they visit the High Chihuahuan Desert, which is where we're located.
So tell us...
But mountains we do have.
Yes.
I'm sitting at a mile high.
Wow.
Where our nature center is located, and we are part of the Davis Mountains range, which is a 35-million-year-old igneous or volcanic mountain range. And our highest peak, just about 10 miles to my west, as the crow flies, is 8,300 feet.
Wow.
So,
wow, that's not a hill.
Yeah,
that's
a hill, absolutely.
So you're from Texas, right, Rick? You're originally from Texas?
I am from Texas. Well, yeah, born in Kansas, but have spent most of my adult life in Texas. And interestingly, because of the scale of the state, and every Texan wants to impress you with its size, I think it's an overblown ego thing. But in any event, because of its size, you know, you can experience many different biomes and USDA zones within one state. And my wife and I have lived in Houston, Austin, Waco, Dallas, Fort Worth, and now the Davis Mountains in the Big Bend, Trans-Pecos. So, you know, we've pretty much sampled, except living on the coast in Texas, we've pretty much sampled everything that the state offers.
Wow.
So tell us about where you are right now, the Institute. I was so fascinated by it as a sort of representative of the landscape of Western Texas. Tell us a little bit of the history of the Institute, its land, and its mission. And I'd love for you to share some of the stats, because the size of the area is just so amazing to think about.
It is. It's a vast openness of, you know, you've heard the expression, this place or that place is in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
We're actually on the far side of the middle of nowhere. So just to add a little punctuation to it.
Right.
But it's a very neat place. It is about 25 miles from Alpine, which is how you discovered us.
Mm-hmm.
And Alpine is home to a state university called Sol Ross State University, and it's four professors from Sol Ross in the mid-early 70s, actually, who decided it was their vision to form CDRI.
Mm-hmm.
And initially, you know, the Chihuahuan Desert, for those who don't know, and by the way, I do have to say one other thing before I forget, because I found this to be somewhat remarkable. You guys judge it and you let me know. If I said to you that your USDA zone in Brooklyn, where you're seated, and mine here are the same, would that surprise you?
Yes.
Well, it did me, so good. I'm not alone. Yeah, we're both in 7B.
Really?
So that's pretty interesting. However, having lived in Manhattan and spent time in Brooklyn, in the late 80s and early 90s, I can suggest to you that our vistas are not really very simple.
I would have to agree with that as well.
Yeah.
Rick. You have somewhat...
the height of some of your buildings are the size of some of our mountains.
Yes.
And the county in which we are located, which is 2,200 square miles, here you go with some of these stats.
I love that.
And by the way, I hope you shared with your listeners that I'm a CPA, so I tend to struggle with words, but I do like numbers.
Uh-huh.
Good.
So our county, one of 254 in Texas, is 30% larger than Delaware, that being the state of.
Wow.
And we have almost 2,000 people in our county.
Almost, we have almost 2,000 people
on my block.
We don't have a stoplight. the apartment building I lived in Midtown Manhattan in the late 80s had more residents than does our county.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I just said the same thing.
Gives
yeah.
you a sense of things. But these four professors had as their vision, because the Chihuahuan Desert 40 years ago, much less so today, was under-researched. It was not well known. There are four major North American deserts, the Chihuahuan the largest, and it just was not well known, in part because two-thirds of it is located in Mexico.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. That's good.
So
that's important
really
to note.
It's the only pure international desert in North America. And their goal, being in Sol Ross, you know, not very far, an hour's drive or so from the border, the Rio Grande and the border, their goal was to conduct research, one, and then disseminate it both within the research community and with the public at large. And so that was the seed corn, if you will, for CDRI, which has evolved into really a nature center operation with a reduced emphasis on research and more just a public venue for people to connect with this biome and nature.
So tell us about the biome, Rick. Tell us about my sense from watching the films. I haven't visited the area. As I said, I've been to different parts of Texas, but not that part. I got a sense of like real wildness and isolation.
Yes. Yeah, it's hard to imagine. My wife and I built a home here about a decade ago, and we're between two metropolitan areas. And if you could see my fingers now, I'm doing quote around the word metropolitan. The city of Fort Davis has 800 people, and the city to the south of us, and it's a 20-mile span, and we're midway. That city is Marfa, Texas, and it has nearly 2,000 people. So to suggest that, you know, it's remote is a bit of an understatement.
yeah.
You really have to purposefully. So, for instance, take Big Bend National Park, which is about 2 hours south of us,
right,
and a little bit east. It's the fourth largest national park in the United States National Park system.
Mm-hmm.
So it's huge. It's 875,000 acres. And it's either the least visited or near the bottom of the least visited.
Wow.
And that is simply because you have to be very purposeful to visit that park. It is literally on the way to nowhere.
Yeah.
On the other side of the Rio Grande River, which forms the boundary between Texas and Mexico, is a very forbidding region of the state of Chihuahua. And there are no Mexican population opposite Big Bend National Park. So literally, it's the end of the United States. When you get there, there's just not much else on the other side of the river, including aliens trying to make their way over. So,
wow.
Right.
So...
Yeah. It's high desert, but
right,
particularly where we are, we're called a sky island because of a number of factors, atmospheric and geologic and some others. We experience a fair amount of rain. We get about 16 inches of rain a year.
Oh.
We do get 75% of that during about an 8 or 10 week monsoon that begins early July and runs through the middle of September. And then the rest of the year, it's pretty arid here. But, you know, because the Chihuahuan Desert, or the CD as we call it, is so vast, elevations run from 1,000 feet above sea level at the lowest parts of the CD up to over 12,000 feet. So, you know, it's a fascinating place. You will find spots where the average daily summer temperature is 110.
Wow.
But we almost never reach 90 degrees where we are.
Oh, because of the elevation.
I checked. I couldn't help check because it gave me more data. What else could an accountant want? I checked, and your temperature today in Brooklyn is 10 degrees warmer than mine here. I'm at 59 degrees today.
Wow. So you get some rain. Do you have distinct seasons, Rick? You know, is there... I mean,
Boy, do we. Yes, we have very distinct seasons. In fact, we just had a program for 8th graders. We had 180 8th graders here last week on birds. And one of the learning stations was on migration. What is it? Why do birds migrate?
Okay.
Where do they migrate? And that sort of thing. And one of the maps that we produced for them, because this is the way we monitor the 160 or so bird species that we regularly have here on our site, is with a reference to the seasons. So we taught these kids about the seasons, and we actually have four very distinct seasons here. Our winter runs from December through the first part of March. Our average day temperature during that period is 59, 60, 61 degrees. That's our high.
Okay.
Our average.
Okay.
And our average low is 29 or 30. So, you know, we have cold nights, and when the sun comes out, because we have 310 days of sunshine a year, so we're generally always sunny, and the earthworm warms up pretty quickly, even in winter. But spring is fabulous here. Our summers for Texans, this is absolutely the place to be in the summer because of, one, it rains, and two, that takes the tops off the heat, and again, we rarely reach 90 when... You know, the program you had just before me and which we listened to here and enjoyed very much, you know, Austin will see 100-degree temperatures, and we never see that.
Wow. So it's one of the least visited parks, and it doesn't go above 90. I think I need to go there.
Yeah. And Marfa.
Well, I would encourage you to. You know, people fall into two camps, I think, when they come out here. It is very desolate, and some people connect with that. It's very quiet and peaceful, and the natural beauty is just astounding. The diversity of plant and animal life, you would think, you know, for most people, you mention a desert, and they think of Lawrence of Arabia and and camels. And in fact, this desert is the most diverse biome in North America.
Really?
Greater numbers of plant and animal, bird, butterflies. I mean, you just go on and on. The diversity of species is astounding. And the adaptations, when you begin to look at families of plants, as an example, and you look at desert adaptations, which you can do on full display in our botanical garden, you know, people are just astounded that we have the beech tree family, as an example, or the rose family, or legume family, or olive family, or cypress and pine. The list just goes on and on. And there are desert adaptations, species adapted to this climate of all of those families and genera. So it gets to be very interesting if you love plants. And you're familiar with them on the East Coast or the Southeast, regardless of where you come from in the U.S., and you come out here and you say, well, wait a minute, we have that same family of plants where I'm from, and they don't look anything like that.
Right.
Yeah.
And that would be an astute observation.
Yeah, I mean, there was even, as I learned from Burl Ives in the video, there's orchids in Big Bend National Park, which I was surprised to learn. There's pockets of moisture, you know, near waterfalls or near water, moving water. There were ferns, and it's just really, it seemed like a really, a kind of a place lost in time.
Lush.
In yeah.
Lushness, you know? In the desert.
Yeah.
Right.
It was.
It really is. On our site, we have a canyon that's formed by a contact point between intrusive and extrusive magma. And we have a year-round pond there that erosion over 35 million years has helped create. Mm-hmm. Groundwater seeps, and we have this beautiful pond. And we have desert crayfish, we have salamander, we have three or four species of tree frogs.
Wow.
And we have in that canyon 17 species of ferns.
Hmm. Wow, that's very cool. Wow. Well,
you know,
I know, I was amazed.
People will go in that canyon and they'll say, this is a lush oasis, it's a riparian area. And we're like, yeah, we noticed that.
Yeah.
Riparian.
Riparian. Yeah. Riparian environment. Well, Rick, unfortunately, we could talk for hours about this, but we only have a few minutes left. I'd like to give you the opportunity to talk about the programs you've established to promote, you know, the center in the community as well as in the region.
Thank you. Well, briefly, you know, our mission is to educate people of any background on nature generally, and then the Chihuahuan Desert specifically.
Okay.
And we want people to experience, if you're a plant person, we have a 20-acre botanical garden, 450 plants each labeled. About 150 species. We have a cactus and succulent greenhouse with 1,600 Chihuahuan Desert plants, which is the largest accession collection in the world. If you like geology, we have that in spades here, including a heritage mining exhibit, because mining, as most people know, is a very big thing in the western United States.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So we have an informational tribute to the mining industry and the impact it's made on our civilization and the industrialized world. We have about 5 miles of trails. We do a lot of work on the climate change area. We had Dr. Catherine Hayhoe about a month ago as our keynote speaker, and you may know her. She's one of the world's most renowned climatologists. And she addressed a group that we put together of a few hundred people down in Marfa. And where I'm from, a few hundred people is a groundswell. I mean, that would be a Super Bowl type of an event. So,
right, yeah.
So when people come into our nature center, we want them to feel welcomed. You can have a postdoctorate in paleobotany, or you can be a land conservationist and a rancher, or you can be a six-year-old being drug along by your parents.
Yeah.
And we've got a little something for all of those people. So this is a place to come and sit on the porch, take a hike, learn about nature, and hopefully walk away with just an enhanced appreciation, because you'll be more conservation-minded if you have that connection.
Mm-hmm. Well, if the films are any indication of how beautiful it is, my mind was already expanded, you know,
by the website.
So we would invite people to go to our website,
yep.
Follow us on Facebook, and if you send us your email, which you can do via both of those places, we will actually add you to our monthly electronic newsletter, so that every month you'll have in your inbox 10 or 12 or 15 pages of what went on that month and what's coming up the next 2 to 3, 4 months.
And the website is cdri.org, is that right?
That's correct. Yep.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. We really appreciate you taking
pleasure.
Time. Thank you, Rick.
That's you bet. Take care.
That's it for our show today. If you have a story to share from your zone, get in touch and we will consider it for an episode or for our blog. The show was written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Krieg. Please remember to subscribe to our blog, www.WeDigPlantsPodcast.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at WeDigPlants to stay current on our projects and upcoming shows, or follow us on Instagram at WeDigPlants, Groundworks Gardens NYC. Thanks for listening.
Happy gardening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.